Five. The Chief Judges and Judges of the United States Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces, hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable United States Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces is now open and in session. God save the United States of America and this Honorable Court. Please be seated.
Well, good morning, everyone, and welcome. Certainly a pleasure to have all of you here today. We hope that you find this proceeding here to be edifying. In addition to welcoming all of you, I'd like to extend a special welcome to David Kahn. I know that Mr. Squires just mentioned him. Judge Kahn not only was a fraternity brother of mine, he also was an ROTC classmate. He's here with his wife, Jackie, so welcome. Now, I'm pleased to announce that this morning, in addition to oral argument, we also have a bar admission procedure. So at this time, the court recognizes Mr. Monahan for a motion.
May it please the court, I move the admission of Jungmin Park of the state of New Mexico and Holly Yamada of the state of Hawaii. I've examined their credentials on file in the office of the clerk, and I am satisfied that they possess the qualifications for membership in the bar of the court.
Thank you, Mr. Monahan. Counsel, my colleagues and I have conferred, and we are convinced of your integrity and your legal acumen. Accordingly, we have voted unanimously to admit you to the bar of this court. Therefore, Mr. Monahan, your motion is granted. Mr. Squires, please administer the oath.
Please stand and raise your right hand. Do you solemnly swear or affirm that you will support the Constitution of the United States, and you will conduct yourselves as attorneys and counselors of this court uprightly and according to law, so help you God?
I do.
Counsel, I'd like to welcome you to the bar of the court. In doing so, I believe it's appropriate for me to recite some aspirational words from my own law school, the University of Virginia, the law school from which Judge Johnson received her LLM. Those aspirational words are these: that those alone may be servants of the law who labor with learning, courage, and devotion to preserve liberty and promote justice. Because you exemplify those ideals, it is a pleasure indeed to welcome you to the bar of this court. So congratulations. Thank you. You may be seated. Mr. Monahan, Mr. Squires, do we have any other matters before the court before we proceed to oral argument?
No, Your Honor.
Very well. Then we will call the case of the day. Our case today is United States versus Strong. As a note of information for you all, unfortunately, our colleague, Judge Sparks, cannot make it here today. He will be participating fully on the record. Major Flynn, are you prepared to argue on behalf of appellant?
Yes, Your Honor.
Major Emmons, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the government?
Yes, Your Honor.
Very well. Please proceed.
Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, may it please the court, I respectfully request to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal.
Granted.
This court should set aside appellant's conviction for violating Article 131 ECHO UCMJ because her conduct was beyond the reach of the statute. When law enforcement seized her phone, they seized the digital contents of the phone. This interpretation is consistent with this court's precedent and is the only one that makes sense. Alternatively, law enforcement believed it had seized the digital contents of the phone, therefore placing appellant's conduct beyond the reach of the charged specification. In United States versus Hahn, this court held that a seizure is complete when there has been some meaningful interference with the possessory interest. That happened here. The government and the Army Court would interpret Hahn and some meaningful interference to mean complete and total interference. That is not the test. When law enforcement took appellant's phone, they took away her ability to do anything on that phone for which it was intended. She can no longer manipulate, search, copy, view, or do anything else with the data that she could and was supposed to be able to do on her phone. Therefore, that was some meaningful interference, and the seizure was complete.
Now, Mr. Flynn, you're talking about she could no longer access, manipulate, destroy the digital information on the phone. Isn't that what she did?
Your Honor.
Using a different device.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So then you're referring here to the fact that it was the digital contents of the phone, and in your brief, you refer to the digital information as being contained within the phone. I'm just wondering whether conceptualizing it in that manner potentially leads us down a mistaken analytical path. We're not talking about a situation where, for instance, illegal drugs are contained within a box. Here with a phone, just as was demonstrated by appellant's conduct, it's possible to access the digital information, manipulate it, destroy it. So to say that it's contained within a phone, is that a conceptualization that can be problematic?
It is not in this case, Your Honor, because the record here only supports that she had the ability to destroy that data. It does not support that she could do anything else with it. She could not view or alter or copy or enjoy the data in the way it was meant to be. She couldn't use Venmo.
How do we know that? I mean, you say that she couldn't view. I mean, say she had. I mean, I think one of the problems here is we're treating all the data on the phone sort of monolithically. I mean, this is an iPhone. We don't have a lot of information about about the facts here, but I assume if she had photos on that phone, that she could have viewed or copied the photos off of her phone. I assume we're talking about, I mean, I don't know exactly what kind of data we're talking about here. We might be talking about some kind of metadata that's in the phone that tells you whether or not the phone was in use at the time the accident occurred. And maybe she has no actual ability to change that data. Maybe she can view it. Maybe the only thing she can do is destroy it. Do we need to parse? We've already parsed between the phone itself and the data on the phone. Do we need to parse even farther down the record to treat photos on the phone, from texts from the phone, emails on the phone differently?
No, Your Honor, we don't. In the first instance, appellant prevails because when the phone's taken, it already is a meaningful interference. Even if all of that data existed elsewhere and she could manipulate or do anything else with that data, that would require her to find an alternate internet source, perhaps a laptop or a desktop, and use the data in a different way that she could do it on her phone.
But counsel, is what you're arguing essentially is that inconvenience equals meaningful interference. Clearly, the interference was not that great nor absolute, because she was able to delete the data within hours of the phone being seized. So where do we draw that line then? And I think that that's what my brethren is trying to get to. Where do we draw this line? What's access?
Your Honor, the line is drawn at some meaningful interference. And it is not simply an inconvenience, as the Army Court talks about. She couldn't wordle on her phone. But it goes beyond that. Cell phones are an integral part of our life. The Supreme Court noted 9 years ago in Riley versus California that we are seldom more than 5 feet from our phones. And a visitor from Mars would think that phones are an important part of human anatomy. They are a vital part of...
The reality, counsel, is that she was, in fact, able to access the data on the phone because of its digital nature. And so what you seem to be arguing is that because it was more inconvenient to do that, that is the equivalent of her inability to access.
It's not the equivalent of her inability, Your Honor, but it is a meaningful interference because she had to overcome several obstacles in her way to then be able to do that one ability she had, which was destroy. But even if this court doesn't believe that that is sufficient, appellant should prevail there. But even if this court disagrees, the fact that she only had the ability to destroy is also important. The ability to destroy is not by itself an indicator of a possessory interest. Oftentimes, the ability to destroy is a crime or a tort and something prohibited by law. And so the fact that she could just push a button and destroy her phone doesn't weigh that heavily in the government's favor.
You quoted a case to us, which I don't quite understand why you did, but you told us that is the most treasured right. That is the most treasured property interest. And she still had that property interest, right? Matter of fact, I think the only property interest you identify in your brief that she may have lost is the convenience of accessing the data from her phone. Is that you have, and maybe I don't want to misstate your position, do you have any, if when we talk about the bundles of sticks, you know, the bundle of sticks, what other stick has she lost other than the convenience of accessing the data or destroying the data via her phone itself?
Your Honor, I acknowledge that the ability to destroy is oftentimes considered one of the most vital interests in property rights. However, the test doesn't look at what abilities appellant retained. It looked at the abilities that
isn't that exactly what the test examines?
I disagree, Your Honor. It's a meaningful interference with her possessory interests. So it's from what was taken from her, not what she retained. And even if we are solely looking at the ability to destroy, we can parse that out in several ways. She certainly didn't have the authority to destroy because that was a crime. I'm not suggesting that weighs in appellant's favor either because that's the entire purpose of the statute.
I mean, you can't concede that it was a crime because then her conviction would be legally
This is correct. She did not, under this statute, is beyond the reach, but she certainly doesn't have the authority to destroy it. And I think I'm not conceding it is a crime, but the government could have charged other things in this case. They should have charged obstruction here, Your Honor. Appellant's conduct would conceivably be covered by other statutes under the Uniform Code of Military Justice. So she doesn't have the authority to destroy the data. She doesn't have the ability or the authority to do anything else with the data, such as view it, enjoy it, copy it, send it to other people. All she retains is the ability to destroy. And just as if she had destroyed...
Do we know that for a fact? She could not have done anything else with the data other than destroy it? Because I don't know where in the record that comes from.
The government would have had the burden to make that clear if she did retain these other possessory interests, Your Honor. It isn't super clear, but the Army Corps was comfortable enough on page 4 of its opinion and page 5 of the Joint Appendix to state that although it is unclear, it seems that's the only ability that she retained with that data was the ability to destroy.
So you're not referring back to the record. You're referring to the lower courts who has fact-finding authority. Are you claiming that that was a fact-finding that we should observe?
I'm referring to both, Your Honor. I was unable to find anything that made sufficiently clear that she had more ability than just the mere ability to destroy on my review of the record. I imagine my friends at the government also were unable to find that because they did not point that out. And so the Army Court's finding of fact there should be granted some deference by this court.
But isn't the ability to destroy the very action or activity that the statute is seeking to prohibit?
It is, Your Honor, and that's what the Army Court really relied on. But the issue with that test, in addition to all of the previous issues, such as Hahn and what the ability to destroy really is that that conceivably has no termination. The mere ability to destroy can only be seen after the fact. You can only look back on something and say, well, I suppose that person could destroy it because we know that they did. And so even if we take what the Army Corps wants to do and what the government wants to do and say that a seizure is only complete at the time it's perhaps been copied or taken to law enforcement and plugged in and put on other devices, a resourceful or violent or desperate individual can always find a way to destroy things. And at some point, this statute has to have a termination. And the government and the Army Corps seem to agree with that, that eventually the statute has to end. But then the test they propose doesn't have a termination. It goes on into perpetuity, dependent entirely on the ability and whims of any given appellant.
But it seems like we have a test, right? The Supreme Court has told us that the seizure has occurred, and therefore, I guess, Article 131E stops applying when there has been a meaningful interference with the appellant's, in this case, possessory interest. So that we come back to whether or not the inconvenience of using a different device instead of the appellant's cell phone is a meaningful interference. Does this whole case just turn on that one question?
That is a key question, Your Honor, without a doubt. And that is the test, and the Army Corps does pay some lip service to that, but then they interpret that test with data as meaning completely beyond the reach of destruction. And that leads us to this test or this interpretation of the test that doesn't have a termination. And we can look to other areas of Fourth Amendment jurisprudence, which this court drew on in Hahn to come up with that test, or at least to apply that test to a crime like this, to see that a seizure is complete earlier. Federal Rule of Criminal Procedure 41 says a seizure is complete when the device on which data is stored is seized. And the government here acknowledges that the phone itself is seized. And Hort, although in just a footnote by the Seventh Circuit, they noted that that is when it happened, when the device itself is seized. Finally, looking to the novel test proposed by the government here, they try to interpret a seizure not from the view of the person from whom something is seized, but from the individual doing the seizing. And even if this court decides to abandon its jurisprudence from Hahn and take that test, appellant would still prevail. Because at the time law enforcement has the phone, they have the data that's on the phone. Even if they don't know what exactly that data looks like, they don't know what those ones and zeros amount to, they still know the data is on there. And as the Supreme Court noted in Riley versus California, the First Circuit's interpretation of the companion case, the law enforcement knew it was on the phone, it's the data, and that data couldn't do them any harm. And so here, likewise, even under the proposed test by the government, when law enforcement has the phone, they've got the data there. Whether they've looked at it, whether they know exactly what texts were sent or what was going on the phone, they have it. So even under that test, appellant still prevails. Additionally, law enforcement agents no longer were endeavoring to seize the phone because they believed they had done it. Prior to them going to appellant's room...
Isn't that where the distinction between the phone as a physical device and digital information as something quite different matters? And the mere fact that they were in possession of the phone, weren't they still endeavoring to seize that digital information? They still had to go through digital forensics and so forth to understand what they had and to be able to actually say that they had it.
Your Honor, at that time they were endeavoring to conduct a search. In Riley versus California, the Supreme Court was very careful to talk about the seizure of the phone and a later search of the contents of that phone. And although it didn't make a holding about when the seizure of the digital contents were, the tests laid out in Jacobson and taken by this court in Hahn is a meaningful interference. And the interpretation that makes the most sense with that is when the phone is seized. But even if this court disagrees with that, law enforcement agents were no longer endeavoring because all of the actions they took indicate they believe their task was complete. Prior to going into appellant's room, they sent someone in there to keep an eye on her. Don't let her touch her phone, because they recognized the risk that she could do exactly what she allegedly did, which was wipe her phone and prevent them from taking any evidence. However, once they took that phone and they placed it in the Faraday bag, they abandoned any sort of protocols to protect the data beyond the Faraday bag. And the only reason they would do that is because they believed that their job was complete. They could have very easily left someone with her until they had copied and searched the data, but they didn't do that. They could have also just ordered her, don't delete anything. And perhaps she was a very obedient individual and would have obeyed. Or perhaps they could have taken out the battery from the cell phone. But they didn't do any of these acts because they thought the Faraday bag was sufficient. And the time that they put the phone in the bag, they thought that their job was complete. They were wrong. But just because they were wrong doesn't mean that they believed they were still endeavoring to seize. They thought the job was finished, and therefore agents were no longer endeavoring. Pending any further questions from this court?
More questions from the bench? Seeing none, thank you, Major Flynn. Major Emmett.
Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, may it please the court. Appellant's conviction for prevention of authorized seizure of property is legally sufficient and should be affirmed. And this case turns on a fairly narrow issue. Were law enforcement agents still endeavoring to seize the digital content of appellant's phone at the time that she remotely wiped the phone? And as we did in our brief, I'll attempt today to kind of focus the discussion on that narrow issue, because that is what is controlling in this case. And in analyzing that question of whether they were still endeavoring to seize, it's important first to remember the standard of review that applies to this case. And this is ultimately a legal sufficiency analysis. And the court is very familiar with the standard that applies, but I bring it up to point out that some of the questions that come up surrounding data and seizure of data are kind of interesting questions in the abstract, but the court doesn't need to reach all of those in this decision. Ultimately, the question before the court today is, could a rational fact finder find that agents were still endeavoring to seize the digital content? And the answer to that question is yes. And that analysis of whether they were endeavoring to seize begins first with the question of, what does that mean? What does it mean to endeavor to seize digital content in the context?
Now, are you saying that the concept of endeavoring to seize is somehow unrelated to this concept that was emphasized by appellant's counsel in terms of applying Hahn and a meaningful interference with a possessory interest?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think the analysis starts with defining endeavoring to seize, and then you kind of drill down from there. And as the Army Corps did, it defines seize using Hahn. And our position is that that was appropriate legal framework, and that this court could follow that same reasoning to reach the same result.
Counsel,
please.
Do you agree with the Army Court's view that if there was an ability to destroy, that it hadn't yet been seized?
At least under the facts of this case, yes, Your Honor.
Well, the reason I ask that is it's sometimes the case that property that has been seized can be destroyed, not digitally, but just in any other method. Maybe you've heard of a case in the 1990s, United States against Mix, where Mix burned down the SJA office at Fort Campbell to destroy evidence. I mean, would we say that any evidence that was in the SJA's office hadn't been seized because he was able to destroy it?
I do think, Your Honor, there's a factual distinction that's important in those two cases, and that distinction goes to the very nature of digital evidence. And so the evidence produced at trial was that this evidence, or excuse me, the property in question, the digital content, there's a common feature on iPhones, and appellant had the ability, it's a feature of the phone that she was able to log in and delete the phone. So that's perhaps there are scenarios like burning down the OSJ where it really is too far removed from the seizure, and that's kind of too extreme. But under the facts of this case, certainly we don't even approach that, because a feature inherent in the phone and the data is this ability to remotely access in a way that you can't with physical evidence.
Well, counsel, isn't part of the challenge, or at least I think part of what the court is challenged with, is that it is a paradigm shift in a way. Because when you're talking about real property, you search in order to seize. Whereas with digital, you seize in order to search. And so is it your recommendation that the court should somehow define a new test when we're talking about digital data and we're in that seize in order to search limit?
I don't think there's any requirement to define a new test. I think as the Army Corps did, applying the kind of rationale from Hahn, the meaningful interference language, is perfectly appropriate, again, under the facts of this case. Certainly down the road there may be scenarios, whether it's technology that exists now or technology that's created in the future, where it does require something else. But at least under the facts of this case, the court can resolve this case without trying to answer every question that could conceivably come up in the future.
Counsel, appellant's argument, or part of their argument, is you would never really know whether the accused had the ability to destroy the evidence unless the accused actually did it. So how would we ever really know when the seizure occurred? I mean, if it had been put in a working Faraday bag, then it would have been seized. If it had taken the battery out, then it would have been seized. If, you know, the password or something had been changed, then it would have been seized. But how are we ever going to know when a seizure occurs if it's not when they physically take possession of it?
Under the facts of this case, we know when the seizure would have occurred, Your Honor, and it would have occurred at the time that CID was able to extract the data, and they had the copy on their own law enforcement computers. They had a copy that was separate and apart that couldn't be accessed remotely. And so I think the Army
unable
Corps...
Unable to destroy.
I'm sorry.
The appellant would have been unable to destroy.
Yes, Your Honor.
But, Counsel, what about the fact that they had the potential to do any of those things? At any moment, they could have put it in a working Faraday bag. At any moment, they could have extracted the data. Why isn't that an interference with her rights? At any moment, they could have wiped the phone. The government could have wiped the phone. Why isn't that a meaningful interference with the accused's rights to that phone and the data on that phone?
I think, Your Honor, that it's some interference, certainly. And so our position is not that there is a requirement for complete interference, but it has to be meaningful. And to define meaningful, you need to look at both the statute and the context of the statute and the way that it's applied and the facts of the particular case. And I think also what's important to remember is that there are other elements of the offense. There is this endeavoring element. And so it's not, there isn't this kind of parade of horribles where you can have a seizure into perpetuity because the government's still required to prove that they were endeavoring to seize and that the accused knew that they were endeavoring to seize.
Counsel, does the government agree that once the government seizes the phone, say in this case they had put it in an operating Faraday bag, would the application of this particular offense cease at that point? And what happens to the phone after that while it's in the government, or after the government has seized it, is sort of irrelevant?
We don't concede that ultimately, Your Honor. I think if you look at the Army Corps' analysis, we agree that simply placing it in the Faraday bag is not enough. And
why wouldn't that be a meaningful interference with the appellant's possessory interest of the data in the phone?
Because as the testimony of the agent at trial, those are not foolproof. And as it bore out in this case, the bag itself is not foolproof. And so you would have to look at the particular facts of each case, but here we know that there was no meaningful interference.
Right. But that would at least sort of solve this problem of not knowing when this particular offense ends, right? Because it seems like the government's not endeavoring to seize after they have effectively seized. Isn't that true?
Certainly, Your Honor. We agree conceptually that once the seizure happens, there is no 131 echo.
Because I think one of the things that appellant doesn't phrase it this way, but one of the things I understand the appellant to be complaining about is the government seems to be benefiting from its own negligence in this case. And that might be true, right? They think they've seized it by putting it in an operating Faraday bag, but actually they haven't. And that gives the appellant the opportunity to destroy it. So there's a sense of injustice, I'll call it. They didn't use those language. I'm using that language. So is that a problem for us?
It's not, Your Honor. And that's ultimately part of the analysis of the dissent at the Army Court is essentially that argument, that the government shouldn't get a benefit from their negligence. We would, I guess, disagree with the underlying premise that they were negligent. As the testimony at trial came out from the agent on the ground doing that was taking the phone, collecting the evidence, she said, "We put it in this bag. I know that it's not foolproof," and they were taking other steps. And so we, I guess, disagree that it was negligent. But even if it were negligent, that doesn't absolve her of any criminal liability. It may seem unfair, but ultimately what she did was a violation of the statute. And so the fact that by happenstance it was because they didn't put it in the bag or it was a faulty bag or whatever reason, that's not a defense to the crime.
Another one of the appellant's arguments is that the government is proposing a new test. Is that true? That a new test that sort of focuses on the level of the government's possessory interests in the phone. Are the government's possessory interests relevant for analysis at all?
I think what appellant is referring to, Your Honor, is kind of the second half of our argument. I hesitate to even call it an alternative argument, and certainly it's not, in our position, a novel test. But it would look at the language of the statute and not focus on this meaningful interference language, but look at, from the perspective of law enforcement, when did they take possession seizure is defined as taking possession. So at what point did they take possession? And that's perhaps an appropriate test in certain cases. We give the example of abandoned property where there is no possessory interest, so there can't be meaningful interference. But under the facts of this case, the court can reach the result under the meaningful interference test, or in the alternative, if the court decides that's not an appropriate test or that there was, in fact, meaningful interference, then it can look to the statute to affirm.
You've started to touch upon something that I'm interested in. You're understandably and appropriately making a very fact-specific, case-specific argument. As an appellate court, we're interested in terms of course, resolving the case in front of us, but also seeing if we can provide guidance to the field. So that trial counsel, that defense counsel, that military judge, as well as the lower courts, the CCAs, know how to apply this principle rather than trying to tease things out of our opinion. Could you articulate for us now what principle, what holding you think this court should come up with that would support the government's position?
Yes, and ultimately I'll caveat it with in cases similar to the facts of this case, because I don't think that the court...
Well, this is a fairly unusual case, don't you think?
Certainly it is, Your Honor. But it's not inconceivable that we're talking about cell phones, that we're talking about the ability to log into the iCloud, similar facts in other contexts. There are a million different iterations of this where we're talking about what if there's not remote access, or a lot of questions that I think the court may not and should not attempt to answer in this particular case because of kind of the unique nature of the evolving technology.
What's the broadest rule that we can make in this?
Yes, Your Honor. Ultimately, I think that for purposes of Article 131 ECHO, you look to the facts of the case, particular facts of the case, and the purpose of the statute to define what is meaningful in that context. And I think that broadly can be applied in multiple different cases.
So that sounds suspiciously like you apply the facts and the law. And I'm a little bit concerned whenever anybody says we should apply the purpose of the statute. It's not our role to try to effectuate the purpose of a statute. It's our role to apply the plain language of the statute. So aren't you essentially saying you apply the facts and the law?
Ultimately, perhaps, Your Honor. But I do think it's important. I guess the distinction that I'm trying to make is that this question of meaningful interference is not answered in the abstract. You can't take disparate facts or even the question of what is meaningful interference for Fourth Amendment purposes and what is meaningful interference for the purpose of Article 131 ECHO and answer globally what that may mean. And so that's why I suggest that it's important to look at the context in which the statute's being applied. And I don't mean to suggest that you need to dig into legislative history or anything like that. Apply the statute, the language of the statute, but in the particular context. And ultimately, it's a different consideration, Article 131 ECHO and the Fourth Amendment. There are very different interests at play, and any analysis should recognize those differences.
So obviously, in looking at these types of cases, or any case, we looked at case law as well, and we've been talking a lot about Hahn, but what about Hoffman? This court seemed to draw a distinction between a situation where law enforcement took digital media, put it in the middle of the room, the accused was present, as compared to remove the digital media from the barracks room and from the presence of the accused. Isn't that a distinction that is important to appellant? Say, this is a situation where they removed the phone from her presence and from her possession.
It may be, Your Honor, for purposes of Fourth Amendment, It certainly is for her own convenience, but for purposes of Article 131 echo, it probably isn't. And Hoffman...
How so?
Your Honor, because the kind of interests at play in the Fourth Amendment analysis, it looks at state action against an individual and their own rights, whereas Article 131 echo, it's almost a flip of the reverse. We're almost talking about interference with the government's rights to investigate and to preserve evidence. And so they are very different interests at stake, and the analysis should recognize that. But Hoffman, Your Honor, it of course, dealt with, they didn't even reach the kind of secondary question of seizure of the data, ultimately by deciding that just placing it in the room, in the middle of the room, wasn't a seizure. That kind of ended the analysis. I just want to address briefly, and I've hit on it a little bit, but appellant's alternative argument kind of regarding the subjective intent of the agents. If the court looks to JA-40, that's the testimony from Special Agent ST, who was there on the scene, and she's the one that ultimately, I think, used the word foolproof. So that was from the words, from the mouths of the people on the ground. They didn't have a belief that it was free from active or passive manipulation. They recognized that it could still be accessed, and that's why they were taking the additional steps of taking it for digital forensic examination.
Major Evans, may I ask a question that hasn't been touched on before, and that is about the findings instruction. You say that was waived under Davis, and then in the reply brief that you have not had a chance to respond to, appellant argues that Davis should be reconsidered. What's your response to that?
Our response, Your Honor, is that Davis is good law and that there is no requirement that it be overruled. And certainly the facts of this case don't compel that. Under the facts of this case, there simply was no error and no prejudice. So setting aside the waiver piece, there is no requirement for the court to set aside its precedent to reach a different result in this case. Pending any further questions from the court, this court should affirm the Army Court.
Thank you, Major Evans.
Thank you.
Major Flynn. Major Flynn, before you get started, your time will continue, begin as I ask you this question, though. Would you like to offer anything to this court in terms of a broader general rule, a principle that we should include in our opinion that would provide guidance to the field? The time should proceed.
Yes, Your Honor. In regards to your test question, the test for data should be when there's some meaningful interference. And for data, some meaningful interference occurs when the device itself is seized. That's consistent with Federal Rule of Criminal Procedure 41 and with this court's precedent. Your Honor, you also asked Chief Judge Olson about Hoffman. And there was not a seizure of the phone, as this court held. And there, as you mentioned, the phone only went to the center of the room while the appellant was still there. Also distinct in Hoffman is that was a consent-based case, whereas here, law enforcement, they physically took it from her under search authorization, not leaving any doubt whether or not she could ask for it back. And so when they physically took it and walked from the room, without a question, there has been a seizure of the phone and its contents. My friend is correct that at JA-40, the law enforcement agent mentioned that Faraday bags are not foolproof. I would just note that occurred after the Faraday bag they tried to use was not foolproof, so they should give that testimony. You should give that testimony the way it deserves. She's able to say that because she has the experience of, in this case, the Faraday bag not functioning properly. Judge Maggs, you asked the government when, in this case, a seizure would have occurred, and they predictably stated the test that the Army Court came up with and that they support, which is when it had been copied. But unfortunately, their answer to that question is always going to be one step after the data or the property or whatever it was deleted. And they mentioned that it occurs when something is in a foolproof ability to be protected. But something can always be foolproof until it's not. The Titanic was unsinkable until it wasn't. And so their test just doesn't work. It's not something we can use to predict when exactly a statute's reach will stop. The government also acknowledged that there was some interference here, and that interference was meaningful. As I mentioned earlier, appellant could not do any of the things for which her cell phone was designed. Finally, Chief Judge Olson, you mentioned and you asked the government about applying the law to the facts instead of trying to effectuate a crime. And I sympathize with the government and the Army Corps, but that does seem like what they're trying to do in this case, is they see something occur that they want to make sure it's criminalized in the proper way. And my first response to that would be they should have just charged obstruction. But my second response is if a situation comes up, which perhaps they're looking forward to, where there is perhaps data is deleted or property is destroyed and maybe it's beyond the reach of 131 Echo, how do we get after that conduct? And the answer is sometimes you just can't. And you're stuck with the facts as they are, and you can charge the crimes that Congress has provided. With the hypothetical that the government proposed in its brief regarding the abandoned property, that would not be prevention of an authorized seizure. That would just be assaulting a police officer, which is a serious crime. And sometimes that's what the government has to take to the court-martial, and that's what they're stuck with. Pending any further questions from this court.
Thank you, Major Flint.
Thank you.
The case is now submitted. The court thanks counsel for both sides, and the court will stand adjourned until 10:30 tomorrow morning.
All rise. The court is adjourned until 10:30 tomorrow morning in Keyport, Washington. Please be seated.
Okay, now what we'd like to do is we're no longer in court session.